Something that doesn't get a lot of press, but I get called on questions on occasion, was as we talked about the seed head level there and the ergovaline levels in it. Well, are there ways that we can manage seed head and manage some of our toxicity levels? We can do it through grazing management and rotational grazing. There's articles that I've read about that. Most of that's anecdotal. I've not seen a lot of hard research which has looked at that in terms of its effectiveness to manage these type of toxin levels in the forage. There's clipping it. That's an expensive alternative, but I do hear people talk about it. And I guess the one that has showed up in the recent years would be used in a herbicide that's called chaparral, and the chemical in there I can't pronounce. So I won't try, but this is the commercial name. It's at a level of 2 ounces per acre, is what's been reported. It has been demonstrated to be effective and suppressing, really stops fescue from going through the physiological changes in the springtime. So it suppresses stem and seed head formation. When you do that and you apply it, you're going to find that the forage is going to yellow quite a bit. So a lot of farmers get pretty nervous from things that I've read that, you know, they wondered if they've killed it. And particularly, I think it's been exacerbated when there's been some dry periods in those springs, which tends to slow down its coming back out of that burn. The one thing, since you've removed the stem part of it, you're not going to get as many total pounds of dry matter produced on a per acre basis. The people that have done it said, well, they're trading the dry matter. What, when you take the stem part out of it, they've got more forage quality. In our part of the world, the one thing that I have to throw in here is we're pretty dependent on clover as some of our dilution strategies. When you use this kind of herbicide, you've just eliminated that as an option. So it is there. As I've read literature, I've seen more of it reported in Tennessee and Kentucky as some of their approaches to manage this particular product. I think when we talk about toxicity levels and producers call me, one of the sort of the definitive research thing when people say, well, do my cows really suffer in fescue or not? Serum prolactin levels tend to be sort of the benchmark response of whether or not those cows are really experiencing it. If there's much fescue toxicity going on, you're going to find those prolactin levels are going to go to near zero. If it's not, they're going to be probably 10 times that. So it's a pretty clear, the one problem from a research tool is it's not graduated. It tends to function a little more like a light switch. If it's there and a problem, it's going to crash. And if it's not there, it's going to be high. And we've never been able to use it as a graduated tool based on affection level. So it tends to be a little more of a threshold and it's done. Rectal temperature has been one of our classic ways. We see the heat stress. We've done a lot of work in behavior where some of the things that we have issues with are mediated through just the animal's behavior. They're hot. They're uncomfortable. They're less active. They're like me in the summertime when I have to work hard. They look for shade. They don't have a lazy boy chair. They're going to be there. They're going to be idle. They spend less time grazing, less time active. Because of that, they're going to have less daily gain, going to have less gain per acre. Probably all this drives, they're going to eat less feed. When they start exhibiting signs of heat stress, one of the things that I think affect us a great deal is they just eat less feed. They're less active and they consume less. And I'll go back to my earlier comment about amounts of protein and amounts of energy, which are important to keep that cow's nutritional reserves there and have her cycling. When we start getting less pounds of feed in her a day through forage, the percent concentration of what she's consuming might look good. Her performance is going to lag behind because she's not getting the total pounds of energy or protein that she needs to meet her goals. Available forage tends to be higher. When you have fescue that's infected, and particularly if it's been fertilized a lot, guess what? They eat less of it. You know, and that's become important as we talk about some changes in fescue technology here in just a minute, which is these what they call friendly or novel endophytes, where basically this is our classic fescue plant here with the endophyte in it. We can have fungus free, and we did this about 30 years ago, and we took it out, and we discovered all the problems that we had with fescue without it. And then through some research, they have gone and found some of these endophytes which will have beneficial effects, which don't produce toxins. And so there's new products on the market that most seed companies would have. There's some that's come out of Arkansas High Mag. The first one on the market was Max-Q, which was a joint partnership with University of Georgia and AgResearch in New Zealand. AgResearch actually had the patent on the endophyte. They'd found it in ryegrass. Basically, they're naturally occurring. They bestow the agronomic benefits with none of the animal problems. So ideally, they can combine the best of both. Now, the one thing that I throw here, well, they have the best of both, but guess what? We had a mechanism in a plant that when it was hot and dry, cattle didn't eat much of it. I've planted some of these grasses, and guess what? That negative feedback loop is not there for cattle. And so when it's hot in the summertime and cattle on endophyte-infected pastures are typically in the shade, these cattle will be out consuming it. So from a practical standpoint, you cannot stock these type of pastures at the same level and the same grazing management that we have traditionally in Kentucky 31 pastures. We have done some work with temperature data loggers with some of these Max-Q, where rather than taking rectal temperatures, we would put a temperature probe next to the tympanic membrane in the ear, and it would record body temperature every 15 minutes. We did this on a seasonal basis. This is in a summer heat, not a terrible hot day, but this sort of an average day that got up to about 85. This is in Georgia, and basically the pink line here would indicate where the air temperature is. The red line, the bold up here at the top, would be Kentucky 31 or infected pastures that got labeled toxic here. The blue line would be the Max-Q pastures. And basically, on a daily basis, on a hot day, those cattle, there's about a degree difference or a little more in body temperature. Again, those are the effects that we'll see. One thing that you don't get presented much in the literature, and it's not totally explained, we also did this in the wintertime. So this would be a Georgia winter now, just to put it in perspective for you. So we've got a day that the high was 50 and the low was 30 here in the pink line again. The blue line is the Max-Q pastures, and the red line are the infected pastures. And in this situation, it's reversed. The Max-Q cattle tend to run a degree warmer than the others. So one of the things at play is that cattle that are suffering from these toxins have a hard time monitoring their body temperatures. So quickly, if we think about effects on the male and female when we get into reproduction, the bull data has just been come out in more recent years. Performance has decreased. They're going to have body temperature just like a growing animal. You're going to see those effects. There's mixed results on changes in scrotal circumference. And those that have reported changes, they've not been dramatic. There's very little, if any, change on semen motility and morphology that's been reported due to differences in fescue infection. And those have been verified by looking at blood prolactin and body temperatures. Even though those have changed, they've not really changed any of the issues with motility and morphology. But in some reports that have come out of the University of Tennessee, when they've looked at the ability to get cows pregnant that were on fungus-free type programs, the ability of the sperm to fertilize an egg in those early stages seem to be an issue. They've not really clarified it, but the thing that they've all pointed to, and Dr. Schreck presented at one of these meetings a few years ago, was that these effects tend to occur very early in embryo development, before day 7, but it was very clear-cut that these bulls were not settling cows at the same level the others. When we go on the other side of the equation, we think about the cow. We've got those issues with body temperature and the prolactin levels. We're going to see differences in cow performance based on hair coat, based on milk production, based on her ability to get bred. when we go back and we start looking at the issues there, there's been some documentation in more recent years with declines in embryo quality and decreased embryo development on cows that were, and many of these times were not grazing cows, but they were cows that had been fed one of these ergot alkaloids to simulate a grazing situation. So they had it where they could monitor it under precise conditions. Again, it's focused on embryo development or embryo issues before day 7. Cows that were diagnosed pregnant at 30 days, beyond that, they didn't really have any impact that they documented on pregnancy or be able to maintain a pregnancy due to fescue. So all of it's pointing to changes or issues that come very early. This is just some of the data that they had in their paper, where basically this is the percentage of embryos that reached the blastocyst stage, recovered on day 7 after estrus. And you see the gray or dark bar is the control, which were not fed any kind of ergot peptide. The red bars were. So you see a significant decline in the number of embryos that reached that stage after estrus. And also they took these embryos and they harvested them and they graded them. So it wasn't that where there's only less of them, they were at a lower quality. So they scored them as they would be for transfer, and they scored them, they said these are poorer quality. Now, can we manage around it? Can we do some things? And we do today. But a very recent study that was published focused, again, this is from Arkansas, but they looked at calving season and what time they could do, and also using some of these friendly endophyte fescues in a limited amount. So their goal was they had a spring calving herd and a fall calving herd that were on 100% infected fescue pastures. And they had another spring and fall calving herd that 75% of the land area or forage that they had for those cattle was classic infected fescue. 25% of the land area for those cattle were this friendly endophyte pastures. So they'd renovated just a portion of the pasture area to support these cows. And then in the springtime, they had one additional treatment, which were the new type fescues of friendly fescue, and it was 100% friendly fescue. The cultivar they used was an Arkansas cultivar called HiMag. And these are the results in a nutshell. The advantage, first of all, was favoring the fall calving system over a spring, irregardless of endophyte level. You're going to see an advantage here. It was more marked in the lowest performance level of all of them were the spring calving herds that were on 100% endophyte infected, which would be the second column. Cows lost the most weight, had the lowest calving rate, lowest weaning weight. The next was in the springtime, where the cows still lost quite a bit less weight. Calving rate was improved. Weaning weight was not much improved. So strategic replacement did help calving rate in the springtime, didn't really help weaning weight. So the best thing that this would show you right now in terms of managing, probably even more effective than renovation, was changing to a fall calving herd. And I think as we look at commercial herds in Virginia, particularly east of the Blue Ridge, I'd say over the last decade or so, this would be a migration that we've seen in a lot of calving herds, would be to move into the fall. In summary, there's some mitigation strategies that we've used. Some of them I didn't touch on because they're sort of standards, but we have always believed in dilution, and it's still effective. Some environments lend itself to dilution with other forages easier than others. In the New River Valley in the Southwest Virginia, we can add clovers fairly easily. I think as you go east of the Blue Ridge and you're in warmer climates, we tend to think about maybe warm season grasses probably as a better or an easier way to dilute some of it. You can renovate with a friendly fescue. It is an expensive process, and really in most situations it's hard to economically justify tearing up permanent pasture and replanting and killing. It's fairly complicated. But now the one thing I do recommend in most situations when people say, I've got some new pasture I want to plant, I recommend planting these new cultivars. The seed cost is going to be much greater, but other than that, it's going to be about the same. The seed head and suppression management is there. I've not, again, seen a lot of data. Most of that's anecdotal, and it does suppress it, but what it means in terms of what you give up totally, I'm not really sure. And remember, the leaf tissue still contains some of those ergot peptides, so it's not totally gotten rid of it. calving season changes, really has an opportunities. And with that, I try to rush through, but I think I've used most of my time, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.